1, 2, 3.
Welcome to In the Studio, a 21st century perspective on history's greatest rock bands. I'm Redbeard, and today in the studio, it's the most comprehensive, best-sounding anthology of progressive rock's first legitimate supergroup. This week in the studio, it's progressive rockers Keith Emerson, Greg Lake, and Carl Palmer.
Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
I wrote Lucky Man when I was 12 years old. I actually wrote it when I was 12, and I never had any use for it. It was just one of those things I'd written then as a sort of naive thing, and I just had it, you know. And it was when it came to the album, and we were due to finish the album there and then. And it was just a question of, has anybody got any ideas? And there was a silence, and I said, well, you know, I've got this. So they said, all right, then go on, give it a go.
From the beginning.
Hi, this is Keith Emerson.
And I'm Greg Lake.
And this is Carl Palmer of Emerson, Lake & Palmer.
And you're in the studio.
Welcome back, my friends, to the show that never ends. We're so glad you could attend. Come inside, come inside.
Cold and misty morning, I heard a warning boat in the air.
This Carnival 9 thing, basically about computers, the way computers take people over. In fact, there was a lot of foresight in that, now I come to think of it. And although computers weren't new at that time, the extent to which they have become dominant throughout society was something that I must say that we foresaw at that time. And I think the line was, load your program, I am yourself.
Carl Palmer here in the studio for Emerson, Lake & Palmer's Anthology.
In the 1969 white-hot London music scene, if you asked any music critic to wager on the most innovative band leaders in the wake of the waning years of Beatles domination, the smart money would have been on Jimmy Page with his Led Zeppelin, Robert Fripp's King Crimson, and a three-piece band called The Nice, led by the dazzling keyboard player Keith Emerson. On piano and organ, Emerson really had no peer, performing in England's colleges and clubs back then, and Keith embraced the unwieldy electronic invention, Bob Moog's keyboard synthesizer, and was determined to explore the musical possibilities of that daunting electronic monster. With The Nice, Keith Emerson quickly developed a reputation for dazzling live audiences with breathtaking virtuosity, a material that seemed light years removed from Bebopalula. When Emerson announced he was leaving The Nice to team with King Crimson's Greg Lake and Atomic Rooster drummer Carl Palmer, the music press saw it as progressive rock's first supergroup. Here's Keith Emerson with me in the studio.
I mean, believe me, I wasn't that schooled in classical music. I didn't go to music college or anything. I happened to like the music for what it was worth. I think if I had have gone to music school or whatever, I'd have probably turned my back against it. But I only played these pieces because I actually liked them as pieces of music. My classical repertoire was fairly limited. You know, I think I knew Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto No. 1. I played it because I had to play it when I was having lessons at the age of 10, 11. But I didn't really have a sincere love for classical music until a bit later on. And Greg had the same musical appreciation as did Carl. In fact, Carl's appreciation of the classics went a bit further than mine. He encouraged me to listen to Bartok. And we just got further and further out. Various terms were linked with us, like, this is a classical rock band. Well, it wasn't, really. We were so ubiquitous in our styles that we decided we really didn't want to pin a name on us at all.
1970 debut of Emerson, Lake & Palmer, who were thrust into a headlining slot on the 1970 Isle of Wight Music Festival. That's the UK's version of Woodstock, attended by an estimated 350,000 to witness a mashup of rock meets Rachmaninoff. Here's Greg Lake.
It may have been the first time in a mass event like that, large number of people, that this sort of music would have been performed. So, I mean, rock and roll had been performed in the open air. But for people to hear a rock band playing classical music, playing all these different, that was quite a new experience for people. And I think that was one of the things that, you know, caught them. Is it's a strange experience to hear something like Pictures and Exhibition in the open air like that at a big event. And so I think it was unusual apart from anything else, and I think it stuck out. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why it got a lot of attention.
In addition to Knife Edge and the impressive lengthy keyboard piece Take a Pebble, the Emerson, Lake & Palmer debut in 1970 also included a simple Greg Lake composition that can only now be confessed as filler.
I wrote Lucky Man when I was 12 years old. I actually wrote it when I was 12, and I never had any use for it. It was just one of those things I'd written then as a sort of naive thing, and I just had it, you know. And it was when it came to the album, and we were due to finish the album there and then. And it was just a question of, has anybody got any ideas? And there was a silence, and I said, well, you know, I've got this. So they said, all right, then go on, give it a go.
He had white horses and ladies by the score, all dressed in satin and waiting by the door. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. Ooh, what a lucky man he was. White lace and feathers, they made his bed, a gold-covered mattress on which he was led. King of his honor and his glory, the people would sing.
Man, he was.
the end of it all, we had nothing to finish it with. So Keith said, well, he was developing up all this Moog synthesizer stuff. He said, don't worry, I'll go out and work something out for it. So he's out in the studio and I'm in the control room. And Keith said, well, look, just run the track and let me experiment with it. I'll see what I can come up with. So I'd heard him just tinkling around and it sounded very good. So I said to the engineer, Eddie Offord, I said, just make sure you record this as he's experimenting. So he started to play. And it was sort of almost casual the way he was doing it. He was sort of playing around and sort of experimenting. So at the end of it, I said, it was great, you know. And I called Keith through the talkback. I said, Keith, you've got to hear this. It's fantastic. He said, no. I know I'm ready to do one now. And I said, no, really, it's great, you know. But he wouldn't have it. So in the end, after begging and pleading, in he came, you know. And of course, it was the Moog solo that now... that became quite famous, and that's the story on Lucky Man.
That was Lucky Man composer and singer Greg Lake, now joined by Emerson, Lake & Palmer drummer Carl Palmer.
First of all, you personally are coming up on an anniversary of just being a pro in the music business.
1 year ago, I'm into my 51st year, so last year made it 50 years, yes.
That's incredible.
Yeah, last year, so that's only 1 year back. Before that, as far as I can remember, I think there might have been an anniversary for an album called Brain Salad Surgery.
True.
I think that could have fallen into that frame, somewhere around there, within months anyway.
Right. It would have been the 40th.
Correct. And something like that.
And we did an actual program around
that. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So 2 years ago, as you saw this period, what was the initial plan?
There was no real plan. The plan was really just to carry on doing what I do. That's always been the plan of life, as it were. The 50th anniversary got celebrated by me just coming back into America and calling it the 50th anniversary tour or whatever. And things started to get very, very busy. And I started to fall behind with stuff. I didn't get stuff completed. But nevertheless, we toured, and we started to celebrate via the aspect of touring. And I produced an album, which was just for this tour, actually, which was going to come out before, but it got delayed. And then with the death of Keith Emerson this year, I decided to hold it back until this tour. And I didn't actually release it. I just sell it myself. I've got, obviously, a sort of distribution contract in place. But I decided to release it quickly or to produce it quickly for this tour and include some different tracks which weren't on the original version. It's a live recording, and it's called Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, Live in the USA, Tribute to Keith Emerson. So that sort of hung over from that 50th anniversary sort of year. I didn't really, I'm not really big at sort of like celebrating sort of, that's probably a big landmark to a lot of people. It is to me, but we didn't make a huge deal of it. I think we called the tour the 50th anniversary tour. I think that's about as far as it went. I don't even think we did anything on a T-shirt. Not because, you know, of neglect or anything like that. It just is not really in my psyche to sort of, you know, kind of blow. Anniversaries are sort of important and they're not, you know, it's one of those things. You know, after the 30th year of doing anything, I think it's better just to be quiet about it.
that's a good point. But at the same token, these are remarkable
things.
They are,
and I'm very grateful to have been playing professionally all the time that I have. Yeah, and I'll probably be able to carry on another. I would think, you know, I might just have 10 years. I might. Depending on health and things, which is pretty good at the moment.
I was about to say, you look like you should possibly doing a side job with health, fitness, and personal training. You look marvelous.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a vegan, and if you know that.
How long has that been?
4 years.
Have you felt a significant change?
I caught E. coli here in America, believe it or not.
Oh.
Which was, and there's two forms, and I caught the worst possible kind, which is when you have it of the urine tract, and which is really bad. It's contagious. When one person gets it out of a group of, let's say, I think there was 12 people all together in Asia at the time touring, that was with the crew and the four members of the band, and no one else got it except me, and it's usually it's usually one isolated case in a restaurant. We know exactly where it was, and obviously that will remain nameless, but it was reported to them. And it was one kitchen serving two restaurants, and I ate in both of them. And that was pretty bad. That's the worst I've ever been in my life. Wow. I mean, I've got a stent as well, but that was a piece of cake. That's nothing having that in, you know. But E. coli was the one that sort of, that knocked me off the perch, yeah. That was 8 weeks in bed, and I missed my first tour in my whole career.
Oh, my. Yeah. You never, ever.
I've never missed a date, no, and I missed that. And they wouldn't even let me play the London date. So that was really quite tragic for me. And obviously I'll put that in the book as well, which is nearly finished.
Oh, good.
It's not like a kiss and tell book, but it's kind of gets into that kind of stuff. So I was really saddened about that, but took 8 weeks, yeah, to get back on track.
Wow. Now, you've mentioned an unpublished book. Can you give us a publishing date?
Well, we were hoping to have it up for this Christmas. With what sort of gone on and the arrangements and the extra sort of responsibilities that I took on because of Keith's death, because I was involved with helping the family, I was involved with arranging this tribute show in Miami, Florida, which had Steve Hackett from Genesis play, and Mark Stein from Vanilla Fudge. We had the Ida Choir come on and sing. We had the Central Contemporary Dance Group come on and dance in pictures. So arranging that at such short notice, and also I dedicated a piece of artwork to him. If you go to my website, www.carlpalmerart.com, all one word, you'll see there's a piece I called Welcome Back, My Friend, to the Show That Never Ends, which was dedicated to Keith, and I wanted to get that done. Plus, there was the live album, Carl Palmer's ELP Legacy, Live in America, a tribute to Keith Emerson. So what happened with it, when all this stuff sort of came in and I had to do something for this tour, which had to happen now because he died the 11th of March. The book is there. It needs a professional read, needs a couple of more anecdotes. And obviously, I think there'll be another chapter now because of what's happened.
Oh, so sure. You've just very matter-of-factly mentioned a couple of major bands that you've been in. I first stumbled onto Carl Palmer 45 years ago on the In Hearing Of album with Atomic Rooster.
Oh, yes. Well, before that, there was A Crazy World of Arthur Brown.
There you go.
That was 68.
So
that,
I'm sure there's a few stories.
Oh,
here.
No, there's a lot of
My
great,
gosh,
there's
it's
a lot
like
of
the
great
last
stories.
Half century of contemporary world music.
Yeah, there's a lot of great stories. And the reason that I probably think that the book is different is that I will come across as a player, not really a rock star, because I'm not I don't consider myself a rock star. A legend I might well be, but I don't put out that kind of rock star image. It's not really part of my makeup. So the book is incredibly factual about, it's not throwing televisions out of windows and things and driving cars into swimming pools. It's none of that stuff.
One of the things, excuse me for interrupting, but one of the things I've always liked about you as an interview subject from the past, you haven't forgotten anything. Do you think, were you particularly healthy and maybe not into abusing yourself even in the day?
It would have started in Haight-Ashbury in 68 with The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. If I'd abused myself, it would have been when we were sitting in some house with Grateful Dead or whatever. But I was only ever, you have to understand where I come from. I come from a very sort of conservative, extremely sort of straight, sort of kind of middle-class family. Grandfather, professor, Music Royal Academy. Father, a businessman, owned shops and also played. Both of my brothers were professional musicians for a while. One still is. The other one went into commerce and did incredibly well. So, we had a very sort of very level-headed sort of upbringing. I didn't drink until I was 22. Had my first drink.
And for an Englishman, that's late.
Well, I've never drunk a beer anyway. I've never had a beer in my life or a lager, and I've never smoked a cigarette. Yes, I have been involved in other things. When I was young, Yeah, I tried possibly everything, but I have a metabolism that just doesn't suit any of that.
I can relate
to that. I'm kind of really, you know, I make coffee nervous, so why would I need to take why would I need to take speed or anything? I don't need that, you know. So anyway, I was only ever here to play and for the music, you know. I thought that was more important than the rock star kind of image thing. Obviously, you know, it goes hand in glove. You need both, really. But I like to be where I am because there's not many people who just do it as serious as what I do. People like Steve Hackett, believe it or not, is on a similar sort of a trail to me and always has been, the Genesis guitar player. And you do meet quite a few people who don't get swayed over into the world of rock and roll. On the other hand, I love to see, you know, these rock stars like Steven Tyler and all this. I think it's great, but that's not for me. I'm just into really playing. That's what I'm all about.
Some of the biggest songs, at least in America, that American radio was gravitating towards in the middle 70s, some of them were very much arrangements of Greg Lake's more acoustic songs.
Yes, very important.
How did that become, I hesitate to characterize it a bone of contention, but something that you were very sensitive to?
Well, you have to understand that, you know, whilst Emerson, Lake & Palmer was known as a progressive contemporary rock band from England, keyboard driven, choir boy vocal sound, nothing blues, you know, nothing real rock. I mean, sections of music would be incredibly heavy and what have you. We understood very early in the day that, you know, to make music palatable to a large audience, you need to be quite eclectic. And whilst, you know, prog music really was based on technology, the latest keyboard, the latest Moog. Introductions to pieces of music would be 10 minutes before the song would even start, you know, and then it was progressive, you know. We realized that songs were very, very important, and we found nothing wrong with the simple three-chord, two-chord, like C'est la vie, song. If it was a great song, it was a great song, however it was played. So we just integrated that into what we were, because we were three individuals. Greg was a very good ballad writer from the beginning. Still You Turn Me On, Lucky Man, C'est la vie, Footprints in the Snow, we can go on. And, you know, that was an integral part of the band.
Certainly.
So when people called it a progressive rock group, we kind of laughed, really, because that was only half of what we did. It wasn't the main thing.
And excuse me, but Greg also tells me that, at least on the first ELP album, you needed one more song.
We needed one more song, and we really didn't need all of the organ stuff that was on the other side, which Keith did. But it was an opportunity to record that particular organ in that particular venue, and we took it. And we thought, well, you know, that's how eclectic we're going to be. I mean, we actually made a big mistake when we recorded Tarkus, not the piece of music. The piece of music is absolutely phenomenal.
It is. I like it now more
and I
than
still
I did
play
then.
It. I still
good,
play it.
Good, you
I
should.
Still,
good.
I still play it with my band. I'm it's not playing it on this tour, but it was the first concept piece, but it didn't follow through. You look at the album cover, it's a little bit childish. It's got this little animal going out into the sea, laying eggs and coming back and doing. And it actually didn't really mean much. As music, forget about whatever concept you think is in there, and there's very little weight in the concept. The actual music itself, the body of music, is absolutely thoroughbred and is a great piece.
Carl Palmer with me in the studio talks about Emerson, Lake & Palmer's 1971 album, Tarkus.
But we tried to do more than just that, and we did. And if you look at the original tape of Tarkus, it's got 17 edits in it.
Oh, my.
Because at that time, there wasn't Pro Tools and things.
No.
So you had to play, and you had to play to a certain point,
and
make sure there was no cymbals hanging over so you could cut it clean. And it was a razor blade job all the way through. But it wasn't the fact that we couldn't play it all the way through. We could, but we couldn't play it perfectly. And what we were after was a masterpiece, or close to. But it didn't have the weight that something like Pink Floyd and The Wall had, which had a political deal behind it. And the graphics married up to the political ideal, and the lyrics all added up to the whole thing. And the music was very good, and the themes were strong. We had this unbelievable music, but it didn't have the full lyrical and story backup.
Not quite as cinematic.
No, it was not. It was a good blueprint to say this is the way we should all go, but it didn't fulfill completely. True. Nevertheless, it didn't hold the album back. No. It just didn't go as deep as what theirs did. Okay. Musically, I think it was... I think it was a lot better. Obviously, I would. I thought it was a lot more advanced at the time.
Next, Keith Emerson, Greg Lake, and Carl Palmer inadvertently invent the mosh pit. Click on the new Emerson, Lake, and Palmer anthology, 1970 to 1998. It's an impressive career-spanning 3-CD collection available now at Amazon.com. I'm Red Beard, in the studio with Greg Lake and Carl Palmer. For Emerson, Lake, and Palmer's Anthology.